So can a fantasy author actually finish the series he's writing? Well, today I have an author here that has done just that. Today we welcome J.V. Hilliard to the Bookshelf Odyssey podcast. All right, my guest today, as I said, is J.V. Hilliard. He is the author of the Warminster series, and it's a four-book series that has two books out already, and then two that will be published, one this fall and then one next year, you said, correct?
That's right. And first of all, thank you very much for having me. I appreciate the opportunity to come on the show. And you're right. Yeah, books one and two are out there in the public and they're available pretty much ubiquitously. Book three comes out around the holidays and book four will finish up spring of next year, 2023.
All right. See, that's one of the things I want to know about in a series is it going to be finished? And the other thing I like is it needs to be finished well.
Thanks. I appreciate that.
yeah, you bet. I'm reading the first book in the series right now. It's called The Last Keeper. And I'll just read you highlights here from the back. I won't even read the whole thing. It just says, a young boy's prophetic visions, an elven princess with a horrifying secret, a terrifying force of evil, and will the entire realm fall to its knees? So just a few tantalizing clues for you there of The Last Keeper.
And that's about it too, right?
Yeah.
You just summarized it. Great.
Yes. Sometimes the back of the books give away too much. So I always try to be careful if not everyone wants spoilers, but
yeah.
Well, tell us a little bit about yourself. How did you get into fantasy writing?
So I've been enamored with fantasy my entire life. I had a fourth grade teacher, an English teacher, went out on a medical sabbatical in May of 1 year. And my substitute teacher, Mr. McKinley, I don't know how he wrangled it, but he convinced the principal that our English curriculum for the last month before we got out for summer break was going to be reading Lord of the Rings and The Hobbit to us. And I fell in love with it ever since. And then I took that idea home. And I told my uncle about it. And my uncle was paralyzed in the Vietnam War. He was a Marine and he had very little that he could do. He was a quadriplegic. And when I was younger, my mother was his nurse. And I lived basically in their house. And it was sort of like Charlie and the Chocolate Factory. There was my grandmother, my grandfather, my uncle. You know, it was like a little crazy American family kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And because of his limitations, one of the things he could do was write. And one of the things he could do was play Dungeons and Dragons. It was escapism for him. Both of them were. And he wrote small short stories, pulp fiction for magazines and such, during his authorship. And that Christmas, he got me my own copy of The Hobbit. And we bought my first box series of Dungeons and Dragons. So I ended up playing a lot of fantasy role playing on the tabletop when I was younger with him that, you know, kind of grew into stuff I did with friends later in life. And then, of course, writing. He was always my tutor. So as I picked up the pen and started to write, and that eventually became a computer, he was there helping me, cheering me on, editing my stuff. And he had secretly entered me into an eighth grade writing contest when I was in fourth grade. And we won, you know, and it was something I always say we, because he was always a big part of that. And we showed up, my mother and I showed up to get the award, and everybody was looking kind of cross-eyed at us saying, "You're not in the eighth grade," but it was just something that always came natural to me. And in my professional career, I do a lot of writing. I'm a lobbyist. And so I do, you know, like policy writing, papers, issue oriented stuff, speeches and things like that for my clients. And but that's all nonfiction. And then COVID hit and that opened up a door of like almost 18 months, a window for me. And the silver lining was I was able to kind of put some pen to paper and really write what I thought was going to be a standalone novel. And my publisher said, we're doing a series. You know, that's the way it goes in fantasy. So yeah. That's where I am. And I'm about halfway through now.
Great. So yeah, I love Lord of the Rings kind of inspiring you on that journey along with your uncle. That's just wonderful when someone can mentor you like that and really just invest that time with you.
Yeah, I would not be doing what I'm doing if it weren't for him. So I always try to pay as much homage as I can to him. He's in every one of my dedications, as is a lot of other close family and friends, my wife in particular, that gave me the opportunity to sit at home and finish this during a lot of downtime, right, with the COVID that we've all experienced. But yeah, he was an inspiration. I sat there. I didn't know any better. I was too young to know that he was any different than anybody else until I got a little older and realized how much he had to overcome to do what he did. And they had fashioned him kind of a handheld device so he could type on an old fashioned typewriter. Mm-hmm. And I still remember like hearing the thrumming of the electric typewriter and the clinking and the clacking as he hit the keys. And if he was able to do that as somebody that was using an archaic piece of equipment in today's world and get published and do it in those ways, then I knew that I could do it. So he was an inspiration for me.
Have you been publishing short stories too, or has it just been novels?
It's been a blend. I publish a serial. It's a monthly serial that comes out for Altered Reality magazine. And if your viewers go to alteredrealitymag.com, they'll see I've got about a 15 episode serial that's ongoing there called The Element of Time. And that's more of a young adult fantasy that's focusing on, a young woman who grows from a child into young adulthood, but discovers that she's a siren at that point. And some of the bad things that happen to her is she's growing up in a fisherman's village and they don't like her kind all that well. And it's how she starts to learn how to harness her magic and use it for good when she could easily use it for evil. So, there are some lessons there that you try to inspire, and you write a little differently for that kind of stuff. And, I expect that at the end of my first series, I'll do some other novella oriented stuff around it, maybe origin stories of some of the main characters in the Warminster series. I've gotten a lot of fan inspiration for that. I've had people ask me when I'm going to do the Blue Connie series or when I'm going to do the Incanis Druwaith series. And these are people that are minor characters in many respect. They're supporting cast, and, people are falling in love with them. So I plan on doing some of that while I'm working on the larger next series that comes from it. So,
yeah. Yeah. Now, as a fan of fantasy, and you've mentioned the tremendous amount of influence the Lord of the Rings has had on you, how does it compare to other works in your mind with works like Game of Thrones or Brandon Sanderson? I know he's a fantasy writer. I've read only a couple of his, but how do you think that compares with those other modern day writers?
Yeah, so I think Tolkien was the granddaddy of them all, right? He was the Rose Bowl. If it weren't for him, there wouldn't be a fantasy genre. And he started something that everybody else aspires to be. And so I look at him as sort of the greatest. I think the best is R.A. Salvatore. He's a contemporary fantasy writer who writes a story about a character that he had when he was playing Dungeons and Dragons. And it's very similar to my characters. Many of them have come from campaigns we've done in various games over the years. And his character is one that has to overcome a lot. There's a struggle there. And I think that very good books, whether they're fantasies, whether they're sci-fi, whether they're contemporary or speculative fiction, all have something that needs to be overcome, something that we as readers can identify with and cheer for the protagonist to get there. And in folks like Martin with Game of Thrones, that doesn't always happen. And it's a little bit more dark. But I do, obviously I love Salvatore. I'm a big fan of the Dragonlance series, which is Margaret Weis and Tracy Hickman. I'm also a big fan of the Sandersons. I like Neil Gaiman's stuff with American Gods and most recently the Sandman stuff. But it's hard for me to categorize them all. I just feel like you've got a greatest and the best, and the greatest is Tolkien and the best is Salvatore.
What would fantasy look like today if Tolkien hadn't written, that it might look very different.
Yeah. He really put the stake in the ground, and I think everybody aspires to be closer like him. And I think that the Martins of the world are those that write real true epic fantasy. Mm-hmm. That's one of the reasons they have a hard time finishing it. Writing epic fantasy is not easy. Mm-hmm. It's long. You have backstory after backstory, and then you also have to look forward to the next generation of characters. And you're seeing that a lot now on HBO play out with House of Dragons, They're kind of taking you back to a prelude of everything that happened in the series that, you know, many have come to love. And sometimes it's hard to adjust to those new characters. The storylines are there and the world may be there. And Tolkien was an expert at that. He was able to show you stuff that happened in the past, make it relevant to stuff that was going on in the books, and show you where it was going to go into the future. And, you know, and that's why I think he's, you know, the undoubted number one.
Mm-hmm. Now, have you had a chance to see the Rings of Power series? And what's your thoughts on that?
I'm watching that right now. You know, and it's not the same. And it's not a criticism of the acting. I think the acting has been fine. I think they put a lot of money into it, expecting that it was going to be super successful. And I know it's run into a couple of hiccups along the way. Sometimes, you know, in this day and age, Hollywood has a tendency to preach to you, and they make you want to, you know, they're going to force feed something at you. And I think a lot of traditionalists are a little upset about how they've changed that in the Rings of Power. But I think that also, you know, there's, you know, what I've seen is some story changes, some history changing. I know Disney's been doing that recently with Star Wars, and what was canon at one time may not be canon now. And I think that we're seeing a lot of that. But, you know, all in all, look, I unplug, you know, I have enough realism in my day job. I have enough realism in my life. You know, for me, the Rings of Power and or the House of the Dragon or you know, Wheel of Time, you know, that allows me escapism, which I think is really important. And I just look at it as a form of entertainment. And is it going to be as good as the originals? Probably not. But you know what? I watch it on Friday nights. So, yeah, they got me, right?
Exactly. Yeah. I'm more of a casual, kind of a casual fan of fantasy. You know, I really enjoyed The Lord of the Rings, and I didn't read them until I was an adult. So I haven't had that lifelong passion for them that many have had. So to me, you know, when they change things and do things differently, I mean, I'm just like, okay, that's fine, whatever. But I get when you have, you know, just dived into this world so much and it has such an integral part of your life that it almost seems like, I don't know if sacrilege is the right word, but you know, or that you're ruining it. Don't change anything.
Yeah. I think most of us have that experience. Like here's what I tell people is that when you read a book is one type of media, right? Mm-hmm. And in your head, you can create the world in any way you see fit. And so when you read my book, it's different than when I wrote it. Like I see it through my eyes. You're seeing it through your eyes. And I, as an author, I'm doing my best to describe to you what that looks like. But in my pages, I can take three pages or four pages to describe to you a very important scene or a setting or somebody's feelings. But when you're watching that in a movie or a TV show, that might be boiled down to one or two lines. It's just a different form of media, right? So it's never going to be the same. And rarely do you ever walk out of a movie theater saying, the movie was better than the book. Right. It's always the other way around. Well, the book was just so much better because it was perfectly done inside your own head. And so you have to give some creative license to those that are taking something that's in a medium like this and putting it in a different kind of media. And whether that is Netflix or a TV show or in a movie theater, it's really hard to do that while keeping everything that you loved about it as a reader in it. And so, you know, and people like to complain about stuff, right?
Well,
so
there's that whole thing.
Yeah, there's that there too, right? Yeah.
Yeah.
So, you know, it is what it is, and everybody's a critic, you know, but and that's fine. But I, you know, there's some stuff that should change and needs to be changed because of the change in the medium, right? Mm-hmm. So that's the way I look at it.
Yeah, yeah. I always find adaptations to be really interesting, just from a creative standpoint, even of what do they leave in, what do they change? A lot of times I find it even reflects on our culture, you know, some of the things they change or add, you know, like even the Rings of Power out right now with the addition of a lot of very strong female characters in that story, that's maybe something they wouldn't have added, you know, 30, 40 years ago, and how that's changed to reflect the cultural changes and things like that. So I find all that kind of just interesting. how that can reflect where we're at as a society. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't, you know?
Yeah, no, I think you hit the point right on the head. I mean, not only with women, but also people of color that are in the movie, or in this case, in the miniseries. And even if you reflect 10 years ago with Peter Jackson, I mean, everybody, you know, Tolkien described his elves and characters as pale skinned, you know, and Peter Jackson followed that to the T. And I don't, I'm not sure that you would even be allowed to see that in Hollywood these days. And so there's a, you know, and sometimes, you know, diversity is good. Sometimes forced diversity isn't. But in this case, you know, I have no problems with any of the actors and actresses in the movie. I think that's, or the show, I think everybody's done a really good job of it. And, you know, the story is, they're still pulling the story through, you know, as it goes. And, you know, and I think a testament to that is when you don't notice it and then someone tells you it, and you're like, oh yeah, I didn't notice it. It was because it was done well. Right. And, you know, but, you know, and that's what I mentioned before. Sometimes they can get a little preachy and force stuff in your face, you know, and in this case, I just think that it's been going along just fine. And so, you know, that's just my opinion.
No, I agree. Yeah. So then I got to ask, who's your favorite character from Lord of the Rings?
So that's a tough question, right?
Because,
because my ultimate favorite character from Lord of the Rings is Sauron, right? He is the ultimate bad guy, right? He is the Darth Vader of that series, right? He is the Thulsa Doom of that series. It's really hard to begin, and even though you don't see him, you're not looking at him as a point of view character. You hate him, you despise him, and you know what he's bringing. He's bringing the realm to its knees, right? And so I love the way that Tolkien hid him, but also gave you enough of him through the creatures. And I'm not talking about just the Uruk-hai and the army he's putting together, but the, you know, you're talking about the ring race and the story behind it and building towards that. And I think Sauron is just one of those ultimate bad guys, big bad evil guy. Right. But you can't cheer for him. Right. So, you know, ultimately I like the struggle of Aragorn, and the way Strider went from being sort of an outcast, and was able to come back and found redemption, and eventually ascended. And I think that, you know, that, that kind of character arc is sometimes tropish, but it, you know, it works because it's true and people want to cheer for that. And so it's hard not to like Aragorn. I think that he would be, you know, my top choice, but I, in private quarters between friends, it's Sauron.
Okay. Well, we won't tell anyone. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I think it was probably the second time maybe I read through the books. I'd been reading through them, and then I thought, oh, maybe I want to wait and watch the movies instead. I mean, I finished them, but anyway, so then I watched the movies and enjoyed them. And then I thought, okay, let me go back now and reread through the books. And then I'm realizing it's like, wow, yeah, Sauron is never really seen. And yet his presence is felt everywhere.
Everywhere.
And it's just a masterfully done. I always think one of the things I dislike about Tolkien is he didn't write more, you know, <there's>, you know, publish more stories, but I think he just put so much thought and work and preparation into those books that they really hold up for deep dives into them and studies and all kinds of things that can be done with them. Some modern day classics, really.
Yeah, it's something that I think that should be in. I mean, just the way that it's written is I would put it in curriculum. You know what I mean? I think that it's just, it's defined an entire genre, and it has spanned over multi generations. And there are really strong lessons to be learned from it if you're paying attention to them.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk a little bit about your book series, the Warminster series.
Sure.
Why don't you go ahead and just introduce to us what it is and set up maybe some of the main characters that we can find in the story.
Yeah, happy to. So, you know, the Warminster series is a 4-book series. It's epic fantasy. So if you're a fan of the classics, you'll like it. If you're a fan of even some dark fantasy, you might like some of the the villains in here, and then ultimately a fan of sword and sorcery. If you like the epic battles and stuff like that, you'll find them both in a very small way and then a much larger way as you get further into the series. But the book really centers around four main characters, three good guys and one bad guy. And one of the bad guys and good guys are linked together in this almost sort of chosen one, false prophet kind of way. And they battle each other throughout the series of the novels. Damus Alaric is a young and upcoming prophet, and he becomes the last keeper. And a keeper is someone that's part of a sect that has portends of the future. And he's the last of the keepers that has the sight. And it's because as this Grey Taurus the Mad, the villain, his arch enemy, as he gets closer and closer to regaining power, the power of the keepers continues to wane. And the secrets of that are spread out over the four books. I'm not going to get into those. But it's really a struggle about someone who's coming up who could be the savior versus someone who's coming back to take revenge on something that happened to him. And then the other two main characters is a gentleman named Sir Ritter of Vulcaneer and Princess Adeline Elspeth. And Sir Ritter is trollborn, which is a term that I use to describe someone of mixed heritage. So it's kind of like a muggle from Harry Potter in that respect. And he's half raven elf, half human. And so he's disrespected by both sides. And, you know, you've got this lowly border knight who the kingdom needs to protect them. But he's also, they all look down their nose at him. And it's how he falls in love with this princess, in this case, Adeline, who is of the highest caste of elves. She's a Vermilion elf. She's the elves that were the first race that were brought when all of the gods and goddesses left the Warminster. They were the ones, so that the highest caste of elves, and they start to fall in love, and their love is forbidden. He, because she's so far above him in station, she, because he's so far below. But it's their trials together after chasing after Grey Taurus the Mad and stopping this chaos that is about to ensue that really bring them closer and closer. And is, do they cross over that line and fall in love, or does their love stay forbidden?
One of the things I really enjoyed is that at the beginning of each chapter, you have a little quote
from
one of the poets. Now, these are poets that you have just came up with on your own, correct?
Right, I just made them up.
Okay. That's what I thought. But so I'll give you the credit for this one. But my favorite one is in chapter 10 at the beginning. It says, "The antidote for 50 enemies is but one true friend." And it's from somebody named
Athabasca, the poet. Yeah.
The poet. Yeah. Yeah.
She plays a greater role in the second novel, but the reason for that is, you know, all of these main characters need somebody, and they all can find the strength to face down 50 enemies if they had that friend standing next to them. And I think that's a real nice life lesson, but I also think it's true to the story. And I try to make each of those quotes that begin at the starts of each chapter relevant to the chapter, or sort of like a preview of what you're about to read. I think that kind of hooks the reader and keeps them reading. And I've gotten a lot of positive feedback on that. I mean, not a lot of people like titling chapters and stuff like that, but I think the quotes really push the story along and get you prepared for what you're about to read. And if you go back and reflect on it, you're like, oh yeah, I get where this was going now. Some of them are a little bit more obvious than others, though.
Right, right. Yeah. That one, I really like that one quite a bit. That if we could take it back to the Lord of the Rings, that reminds me of like Frodo and Sam, you know, just that friendship they had and what he was able to do for Frodo because of that. So, that was one that really jumped out at me, and I thought, ooh, that's one I got to write down. That's a good one.
Oh, good. I'm glad you like that. Yeah.
Your third book is coming out... you said this fall. Do you have a publication date in mind?
We don't have a publication date. It'll probably be the second week in December.
Okay.
It'll be called The Trillius Gambit. And it just like the rest of them are going to be run through Dragon Moon Press, which is my, if you can't tell by the name, it's sort of a genre specific publishing house, small one, but you know, it's been really fun working with Gwen and I think that, the goal there is to get it out right before the holidays. And then, Book four, Echoes of Ghostwood, will be the final installment in the Warminster series, and I would expect that April or May, and that's a little bit too far out to kind of predict.
Sure, sure. And then all your fans will be demanding for more and more. And
we'll see. You know,
more,
yeah, yeah. You know, that's the plan from a business perspective. Is if this is as successful as it's been, you know, look, my first book, I was a debut author. I didn't know what to expect, and we exceeded expectation in terms of publication. And in this book now, we've already, you know, within the first couple of weeks, we've already hit sales that we had. Took us 6 months to get to it from the first one, but all of that sort of, like, you know, keeping your head down, nose to the grindstone kind of stuff is paying off. And I'm hoping that that continues to kind of snowball for books three and four.
Right. And then, well, I was going to ask, I guess we kind of already answered it, but what are your hopes for the future for this series to do more in this world?
Well, yeah, I mean, I'd love to do a second series about this. I think that, you know, I have the advantage of knowing how book four is going to end, and there's going to be some undone shoelaces that will need to be tied there. But also, I've had the privilege of licensing the intellectual property of the Realm of Warminster to an altered reality. It's basically it's called a Melderverse, which is a video game company that's making an augmented reality and virtual reality game out of it. So you'll, in about a year and change, you'll be able to download the game and play it either on your computer, or you could play it on your phone like you would Pokemon Go or Harry Potter in an augmented reality way, or you could put on your Oculus or other headset and play part of the game through virtual reality. So, you know, that's something I didn't expect. People ask me all the time, is it going to be making a movie, or where's Netflix? And all that. And even though that's great and it's pie in the sky stuff, and there's zero expectation for that, these guys came calling early, and it's been great to work with them. And it'll be, you know, if not the first of its kind, one of the first of its kind.
See, that was my first thought when I started to see virtual reality really becoming a thing that people could afford to buy. I'm like, all right, give me a sword and a dragon. I'm ready to go.
Yeah, that's right.
Or that's a lightsaber, right. You know, I take a lightsaber.
Yeah, no, there's no problems with a lightsaber. Work that in. If you can Excalibur, I'll take it, right? Yeah.
Right, right. Yeah, that's going to be fun. So that's amazing. I also wanted to point out, too, that the I'm kind of a sucker for cover art. In the book, this book, The Last Keeper, has a beautiful cover on it. And the other books I saw of yours, just really well done artwork.
Yeah, I can't take credit for that. I'm the idea guy, and my illustrator is a woman in the UK. Her name is Larch Gallagher. Mm-hmm. And I swear to, I don't know, maybe there are cover contests somewhere, but the series, and in particular book one, should be entered into it. I get compliments on it all the time. I even got, and I say this a few, on a couple of interviews here or there, I had a 2-star review one time. And it was on Amazon or Goodreads, I can't remember which. And the review was like, I bought this book off the shelf. I saw the cover. I fell in love with it. I wanted to love this book, but I couldn't get past page 50. Did not finish. 2 stars. And for the first 5 seconds, I was like, what do you give it a chance? Get past. And then all of a sudden I was like, well, the cover did its job. It sold, you know. And so it was like the constructive criticism in it was like for me, but not for the cover did its job. It sold. And, you know, I really think that Larch has been great to work with, very accommodating. She's taken, you know, visions from the book and made it come to life in the illustrations. Some of which are, you know, like photo manipulated, others of which are a true illustration stuff. So I, you know, my hat's off to her. I can't take any credit for it though.
Does she read the book beforehand, or do you just try to tell her what to do?
I give her copies of the book. I don't think she reads them, but no. That's okay. I tell her what's inside and some of the things that she needs to look for as part of them that will reflect what's going on. And I know that that runs against some of the publication logic, which is it doesn't matter what's on the cover. You just want to sell the book, right? So it doesn't have to be what's in the book. In my case, I actually like the fact that it's a preview to what's in there. And on the cover of Last Keeper, you see Damus and his glowing eyes and Ritter sort of shadowed in the background on the bridge with, you know, his War Falcon Storm flying out of the sky with the castle in the background. And I think it speaks to two of the four main characters while also providing sort of like this kind of ominous setting with a little bit of hope with the flash of light. So I think there's a lot of undertones in that, that if you read it, you go back on it, you're like, oh yeah, I get what the cover's about now.
Yeah, I love that one. Well, see, I like when the cover makes sense and ties into the book, you know. It's that it just inspires your imagination, and
I'm the same way.
Yeah, well, let's talk a little bit about some of your favorite books. But I like to ask, you know, what's your favorite book of all time? Maybe would it be safe to say it's Lord of the Rings, or
No, it's actually Dracula. By Bram Stoker. Yeah. And I love the way it was laid out. I love the subject material. I have a penchant for things that are gothic, even though that may not be gothic and more Victorian. I really don't care. I love the idea of it. And the way it was written through the eyes of the varying characters with multi points of view, coupled with this sort of diary of things that you see through Jonathan Harker and Wilhelmina Murray and Dr. Seward. And you read that, and I don't mind the head hopping, you know, and it, for me, it was a lot of fun to read it. I read it every October just to kind of revisit it. It's my favorite piece of literature. I know that might be a little goofy to say compare, you know, cause it's not in fantasy adventure at all. Mm-hmm. But you know, if I had a rank series, and you asked me to, you know, kind of point at any singular book, I think Two Towers, in the series Lord of the Rings, and or the Dark Elf trilogy by Salvatore, in particular Homeland, were my favorites, just because Homeland was so immersive. You go into a culture that you can't experience, but as a player of the game of Dungeons and Dragons, you've always wondered. And these are kind of like the Dark Elves are sort of the big bag evil guys of a lot of like D&D literature. And so, you know, I think Salvatore brings them all to life in a way where you see he's created this entire world underneath, you know, in the Underdark. And, you know, for me, I've tried to emulate that in many respects with Warminster. And I try to put, you know, time and history in different ways, even things that are small, like calling coins something different than gold and silver. You know, I call them, you know, laurels and sheaves for copper and mm-hmm. palmettes for gold, or there's a mint where they're made, and or, you know, the kind of stuff that they do in each barony. And, you know, I think the sigils and the coats of arms, I think that all helps to world build. And I think he did that incredibly well, perhaps only second to Tolkien. But I think that, you know, that if you're asking me for a favorite, it's Homeland by Salvatore, because it kicks off a 40 book series, and or Two Towers by Tolkien, because I think that was the best of the three.
And I still struggle with the ending of The Return of the King in the book anyway. Kind of going on longer, it doesn't really end when I thought it would, and I don't know, I still kind of struggle with that part of it, but yet I still reread it off and on because it's just so good. Yeah.
It's one of those, when you look at my copy, it's dog-eared, it's so, I've read it so many times.
Yeah.
You know, and I still have the same one I had when I was in high school, so like, oh, you know, it's something that you can always revisit. It's a fun read. It's not heavy like Donaldson or some Asimov mm-hmm. stuff where it's difficult. You have to really be in the mood to read their stuff. And it can be, you know, dense, where a Tolkien, you can breeze through. And once you realize that you can forego knowing all of the history of it and pick that up, and that's just detail that kind of builds that world for you. Mm-hmm. And you can get to the meat of the characters. That makes it an easier read too. And, you know, and I think the same thing for, you know, the series as a whole. That's why I like Two Towers, was, you know, Two Towers gave me the finality of the Battle at Helm's Deep. You know what I mean? And it was mm-hmm. like, that was the turn of the tide, you know, and it was like, now all of a sudden we can see the greater war coming in Return of the King. And in the first one, it was very ominous. And I liked that too. It had me hooked. Nothing wrong with, you know, the Fellowship. I really, you know, but if I had to rank the three, Two Towers would be the favorite of two mm-hmm. of the three.
You know, it introduces the character Gollum and Smeagol, and you really, well, I mean, you're introduced to him in The Hobbit, but I don't know, he's kind of in a different place now in The Two Towers. And when I first read it, I don't think I read The Hobbit. I hadn't read The Hobbit yet. So I just kind of jumped in with The Lord of the Rings. And I kind of found his character, you know, Gollum, to be annoying. Maybe I had just watched The Phantom Menace too many times, and I was thinking, oh, it's another Jar Jar character.
Jar Jar, you know? Jar Binks.
Yeah, yeah. But so somehow watching him on screen, you know, with Andy Serkis, it completely changed my whole perspective on the character. And so then I go back and read it, and I'm reading it deeper with a better understanding of his torment, and I'm like, wow, that's amazing.
Yeah, you know, I had The Hobbit read to me first, so I know that's, you know, it made the Lord of the Rings series better for me because I had read The Hobbit, and you're cheering for Bilbo, and there is that conflict between Bilbo and Gollum that's revisited with Frodo later on, and I think that the, you know, the way that Tolkien did it too, I had no problems with. I like the fact that he was kind of not comic reliefy, but really sort of like important to the plot, but also part of the villainy of it, right? And it shows how he could be corrupted by the One Ring, and even hobbits could be corrupted even over a period of time, and how the ring corrupts you based on your level of power. So it would have corrupted Galadriel or Gandalf in a way that would have been immense, where it takes forever to corrupt a hobbit because they're just genuinely good. So like there was a, you know, there's stories to be told in there, lessons to be learned, you know, and I think that Sméagol slash Gollum is a great way that Tolkien was able to do that.
Well, and I wanted to mention too, I'll be rereading Dracula in October this year. I've read it once or twice in the past, and I'm do we're doing I'm d doing a kind of a group read thing with some folks next month. Well, I guess when this episode comes out, it would have been last month, but anyway, in October I'll be reading Dracula again with some other spooky Victorian stories and things. So I'm looking forward to it. It's the first time I read it, I was kind of blown away. Like, wow, this I can't believe it was written all the way back when they said it was, you
Yeah,
know.
you know, it's a modern story written in a time where they may have frowned upon some of the stuff that was in there. But I think what attracted me to it, and I think this is true of anything that is fictional, there has to be a thread of reality in it to make it believable. So you can suspend, you know, disbelief for enough of the time. And in this case, you're talking about a vampire, right? But here, you know, he used the appearance of a Russian schooner. That had it's literally sailed into a port with no one on it. That happened, and then he took that and baked that in to make it look like there was this mysterious count that was coming from Romania that was sailing in and killed everybody on that boat. Or some of the murders happened around the sites where Jack the Ripper was. And in that time, if you reflect back on that, I mean, the people that are reading that stuff are reading around the time of Jack the Ripper. So like that kind of stuff could really, you know, scare. And then I think the thing that it is kind of racy, you know, for its time, there's some, you know, sexual scenes in there that I'm not sure. I mean, today you would pass over them and not think about it. But when you reflect into the time frame in which it was published first, I think there are things in there that were might have been first. I don't know. I'm not a Dracula historian, but I'm going to guess that there are things in there that might not have been seen in literature of the day.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I mean, even isn't there's kind of a horrific scene that, well, several that you're like, wow, that's try to again imagining Victorians reading that, you know, it's like
Yeah, you have
was it?
Dracula stealing a baby. You've got, you know, the
Yeah,
three.
that's what I was thinking of. Yeah.
Yeah, he's got the three nagging wives that he can't get rid of, and he wants to leave them behind, and yet they're trying to seduce Harker, but Harker's his key. He can't let them do it, and he tells Jonathan to stay away from them, and they're like their own succubi, right? Like they're coming for him because
Yeah.
they don't know, and Harker's just learning his own fate, and so there's this tension that's there, but it's done in a way that's so sensual, the way that he describes it. It's almost as if, you know, it's, you know, it's I'm sure it was considered soft porn for the day. I don't know what term they might have had
Oh, I'm
back
sure.
then, but it's
Yeah,
stuff that now
yeah.
you read and you're like, I got it, you know, but then it's I'm sure it was turning heads.
Yeah, like, whoa, hey, what is
Yeah.
this? Yeah, this is trash. Better go read that
Yeah,
again. Yeah. Make sure there's nothing in there.
right,
Yeah.
yeah. Did I read that right?
Now,
Yeah.
do you have a favorite adaptation of Dracula?
You know, not necessarily. There was the 70s version that I believe Christopher Lee was in that I enjoyed. I thought that was really, you know, tied pretty tightly to the original. Not a real big fan of Gary Oldham's version. Nothing against him. I thought he did an excellent job, but I didn't think anybody else in the movie did an excellent job except for perhaps the Van Helsing, you know, stuff. But, you know, I thought it was that was a little bit too edgy and artsy for me. But, you know, I have, you know, for me, I consume anything that has a vampire in it. It's just it's my favorite. I did one day. I know I'll write a vampire novel. I know it's not right now, but you know, I think that, you know, I get stuck. I mean, I Twilight. I watch that. I watch Vampire Academy. It's hard to admit, but I do. Buffy the Vampire Slayer. I've watched when I was younger. You know, and it's like you think about it, and you're like, oh my God, this stuff is not good, but I watch it religiously, and I don't know. There's a fascination there for me, you know. But I do like the underworld stuff with Kate Beckinsale. I thought that was a lot of fun. I didn't like the Van Helsing adaptation with Hugh Jackman. I thought that was a little too Hollywoody. I like dark. My favorite vampire movie is Salem's Lot with this Nosferatu-ish kind of vampire that Stephen King wrote that was adapted into that movie back in, I'm guessing, early 80s. Maybe I was really, really young for that. But, you know, I think that that one scared me and it would still scare me. That and you know, and I think that's my favorite kind of thing where there's something gritty, something vicious, and you don't get a lot of that in modern day vampire stories. So,
I like vampire stories. There's an old one that was out even before Dracula. It's called Carmilla by Sheridan
Lefadu.
Le Fanu, I think
Yeah.
it's his. Yeah, that's it. Yeah. That's a good one.
It is.
And then but my guilty pleasure movie is Dracula Dead and Loving It with Leslie Nielsen is in it.
Yeah.
What's the comic what's his name? Mel Brooks. That's it. It's a Mel Brooks movie. That's a guilty pleasure. I like that
Yeah, Mel
one.
Brooks is a really talented guy. I don't think there's a single Mel Brooks movie I've seen and not liked. Like Spaceballs. I mean, you go through the list. I mean, and but you know that you know I think he's got a similar sense of humor as I do. And you know, I think that if I had to choose one that was, you know, kind of a guilty pleasure, it would probably be Underworld. I mean, I know it's sort of violent and guns and vampires don't always work, but Kate Beckinsale in a tight black leather thin in the rain at night as a vampire, I'm in. You know, give me all that all day long. Yeah,
I'm sold.
right.
Yeah. Awesome. Well, we started off in Middle Earth and ended up in Transylvania, and I'm not sure how that
Yeah.
happened,
I'll take it.
but
I'll take it.
all right. I just want to thank you for coming on. We better wrap things up here, but again, it's the Warminster series is on sale now. Books 1 and 2 are out. Books 3 and 4 are coming. Where can folks find you online if they want to reach out to you?
Yeah, I'm pretty available. They can find me in a lot of different places. My website is jvhilliard.com. If you're looking on social media, you can find me at JV Hilliard Books on Twitter, Instagram, and TikTok. Facebook is just JV Hilliard. And then, of course, you can go to Dragon Moon Press to purchase my novel, or else you can find find it pretty. Like use the term ubiquitously earlier, pretty ubiquitously. You can find it on Amazon, Barnes and Noble, you know, Kobo, Rakuten, you know, Apple Books, you know, places where Scribd, places where you're going to go. And I also have an audiobook version you can download on Audible and a variety of other places too, and platforms.
All right, excellent. So, best of luck to you as you got no more writing to do and all the joys of editing and all that. So,
Love it. Can't wait to get into editing. Love it.
yeah, I'm sure.
Yeah. Man, thank you very much
All
for having me
right.
on the show. I appreciate it.
You bet, and take care.
All right. Thank you, sir.